Well, good afternoon, and welcome to Power for the People here on Solar Power, WERU FM, 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor, and everywhere in our solar system at weru.org. I'm your host, Steve Cowell. Power for the People regularly covers energy technology and homeowner solutions that relate to your energy budget, and yes, to your climate impact. And the climate impact and energy issues are where we're going today with two staff members from A Climate to Thrive on Mount Desert Island, a program that started in 2015 that we did cover on this program several years ago, as an example of how Maine really should be dealing with the climate issue and with building construction, renewable energy, smart energy solutions such as electric vehicles and heat pumps, all of which have gotten lots of coverage here and no doubt you've seen lots of coverage in other places, especially with heat pumps. In fact, just last month, we had Efficiency Maine on to talk about their various incentives. And so if you missed that program, you can find it on the archives here at WERU. So all of those are topics that we have talked about on Power for the People. And frankly, if I may editorialize, A Climate to Thrive is all about power for us people, right? So the guests today are Brianna Cunliffe of the Community Engagement and Resilience Coordinator for Climate to Thrive, and Beth Woolfolk, Manager of Renewable Energy and Planning, Renewable Energy Planning and Policy. So I'll give them a little bit more opportunity to introduce themselves in a few minutes. But first, as I usually do, have a few general energy headlines of interest that might lead into our conversation as well. So Governor Mills announced a week ago that Sears Island will be the site of the future offshore wind staging port for Maine, with a target date to come online in 2030. The announcement called the opportunity for offshore wind a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Maine. And in fact, we have been talking about this for at least a decade, it seems to me, maybe more. Interestingly, and you may not be aware of this, the day after the Mills announcement, the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center announced that a 47-acre parcel in Salem, Mass. Will become their second offshore wind facility. So Salem, Mass. Is a port also on the Gulf of Maine, and the plan is for the facility to be operational in 2026. Yes, the plan is for 4 years ahead of the Gulf of Maine, the site on the Gulf of Maine. And Massachusetts already has an operational wind port and have since 2015 in New Bedford, which is not on the Gulf of Maine. It's on Long Island Sound. But there's already electricity flowing into that from the offshore wind farm off of Massachusetts. So two more issues to be learned about, I think, relative to the future of offshore wind. And I do plan to have to cover that here on Power for the People sometime in the near future. Some other tidbits here. The U.S. Department of Energy announced that 40% of U.S. electricity is being generated by renewable sources as of 2024. That's really good news. And as an aside, the main grid is something like 75% renewable if we include hydro. And the U.S. Energy Administration also announced a projection that solar and battery storage will make up 81% of new U.S. electrical generating capacity in 2024. Again, really good news and may well relate to things we're going to be talking about here in terms of successes on Mount Desert Island. Last time I checked, only maybe 3% of Maine homes have solar power, and that's a bit disappointing. But we are coming on based on better politics than we've had at times in the past. And I will say, too, that the U.S. Energy Information Administration also projected that we are expected to produce 14% more energy from the sun this year than we do from hydropower. And that, in fact, is a pretty big switch from where we've been at times in the past. And finally, an interesting tidbit that I will be interested to know if you folks from A Climate to Thrive have run into yet. And I saw this in a number of places online. And that is that a transition to a heat pump water heater, domestic water heater, from a traditional electric water heater will save enough electricity to power your electric vehicle. And that's a heck of an interesting selling point. And I've kind of done a back of the envelope calculation on that. And I'll accept that conclusion. All right, so with all of that said, and perhaps feeding into our discussion a little bit, I want to welcome Brianna Cunliffe, who is the Community Engagement and Resilience Coordinator for Environment, A Climate to Thrive, and Beth Wolfork, the Manager of Renewable Energy and Planning. And Brianna, let me just start with you, because I've also seen that you have a collaboration going here on WERU that doesn't involve Power for the People. But give both of you in turn a chance to talk a little bit about who you are, where you came from, what your role is at A Climate to Thrive, and again, your background. But Brianna, why don't we start with your collaboration with WERU?
Sure, Steve, and thanks so much for having us on. So yeah, as Steve said, my name is Brianna, and I should mention that I serve as the Community Engagement and Resilience Coordinator at A Climate to Thrive through the Island Institute Fellows Program. So I am one of many Island Institute Fellows placed on islands and in coastal communities across the state engaged in this kind of community development work. And I have the unique pleasure to work with A Climate to Thrive. I come from a background really focused on climate action and seeking an energy transition that's rooted in what's beneficial to communities. I grew up in a coastal town in North Carolina that was hit repeatedly by worsening storms and really developed a passion for climate action, but noticed a profound lack of action or conversation in the community that I came from, which is why I was so drawn to the work of A Climate to Thrive, which started out in 2015, as you say, from community conversations around potluck dinners and folks talking about climate change and wanting to see what their community could do to take action. And so I'm honored to be part of the team. And as you say, have been collaborating with WERU to produce a new 5-minute weekly spot on Thursday mornings at 8:30 called Climate and Community Main Voices for Action, which really focuses on stories of all the good work that's happening across the state to take climate action and build climate resilience. So it's been an enormous amount of fun talking to different folks leading great initiatives across the state and sharing their stories. So yeah, and it's myself and also my colleagues at A Climate to Thrive will be hosting different spots of those shows. Yeah, that's every week on Thursdays at 8:30. So I'll pass it to my colleague Beth.
Thanks, Bree, and thanks, Steve, for having us on today. So I'm Beth Wolfolk. I'm the Manager of Renewable Energy Planning and Policy for A Climate to Thrive. And I've been lucky enough to be in this role now for about 3.5 years. I was drawn to this work because of, I've been drawn to this work from a very young age, but I ended up deciding to go to the University of Maine for environmental science with a focus more in agriculture and soil sciences. I just really loved figuring out systems and how we could potentially save the planet through the systems that exist that we all use. And I remember being in an environmental ethics class during my last semester at UMaine and feeling really disappointed by the lack of action that's been happening regarding climate, especially in the U.S. And I remember looking at A Climate to Thrive's website and thinking, oh my God, this is exactly what we need. This is exactly the type of community action that needs to be occurring in order to make the changes that we need and do it in a way that addresses equity and injustice across the U.S. and the world. So I applied after I graduated or a few years after I graduated and I'm lucky enough to be here today. So and now I work, as I said, as the Manager of Renewable Energy Planning and Policy. So I work with the community at kind of all levels. I work with municipalities on municipal scale solar projects. So potentially on rooftops or landfills where they'd like to site it. I work with other nonprofits, businesses that are interested on the island in solar. And I work on developing programs with contractors to help make solar more affordable for island residents. And we do that through Solarize MDI programs. So bulk purchases that drive down the cost of solar installation. We're also looking at co-op solar, which will open up access to ownership for community members that do not have the upfront funding for putting solar on their rooftop, or maybe don't even own a home or have a roof available to use as a solar project. So that's a way we're trying to open up access to more and more people across the island, and in a way that's replicable for other communities across the state. So I'll leave it there for now.
I appreciate that. And both of you have the right background and certainly the right attitude as Climate to Thrive does. And one of the things that we do want to explore here, Beth, a lot of what you just said in terms of specifics as a model for community action and as a model for other communities to get involved in this same way. And I'll be interested to know whether other communities have reached out to you guys to talk about how you went about doing it and how they can do it as well. And just an aside here, I think one of your bigger projects was the solar PV on the high school. And of course, that was done by the same company that did the solar PV for WERU. So, we've got lots of collaboration and connections going on. And I might add, too, that of your board members, and I'm just looking for the names here, Ken Colburn is somebody that I've known for a long time. Steve Katona, the former president of College of the Atlantic, was somebody that I've known for a long time. And Margaret Jeffries as well is somebody that I've had a connection with. So my connections on Mount Desert Island go back to doing the water quality down there from 1979 into the 2000s when I was director of the George Mitchell Center at UMaine. So I have lots of connections with Mount Desert Island as well. So just a quick reminder, you're listening to Power for the People here on WERU FM 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor. And the guests that you have heard from and we'll hear from more momentarily are Brianna Cunliffe, the Community Engagement and Resilience Coordinator, and Beth Wolfolk, who is the Manager of Renewable Energy and Planning. And Brianna, thanks for mentioning the Island Institute. They're doing such good things and so important for the island culture and residents through the years, and somebody that I've been familiar with for a long time, now a member of the Main Island Trail Association who spun off from them, but I've known of them for quite some time. So let me start by asking, you both have touched on it a little bit, but talk about how a Climate to Thrive came to be. Leadership matters. You'd have a conversation around, a barbecue grill, but you need initiative and a leadership and Energizer bunnies. So relative to starting to talk about how other communities can get involved, tell us how it started and how it evolved. How's that for a simple, easy, short question?
Yeah, I can take a stab at this. I think it was before both of our times and we sort of got to come into this ongoing work. But I think that A Climate to Thrive's roots are still really evident in the way that its leadership operates today. You mentioned some of the amazing partners that we have on our board. And A Climate to Thrive started out, of course, with no staff, just community members, volunteers coming together and figuring out how they each could make their own unique contribution, right? And so some of those folks held formal positions of power, right? We're linked to big institutions on the island, maybe we're elected officials, but many didn't, right? Like many were teachers or healthcare providers or other folks who have these unique well of strengths, but not someone who's considered, right, an energy expert or a policy wonk in a traditional sense. And yet we're able to sort of form this group that brought together a lot of different formerly disparate strings or areas of the island to find the places where we could create those win-win-wins. And so I think that even though now we are a staff of, we're a staff of six these days, and that's seen some pretty rapid growth in the past couple of years, we still have that model where it's very much just not the named staff members on a Climate to Thrive's website. Our work really is this broader swath of the community that where ACT got its start, and our board members and volunteers being a really active part of making the work that we do possible, right? And so there is sort of leadership that exists, but it's also more of a truly community supported model, which is something that I find really striking. Beth, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I think you summed that up really well, Bree. Like you said, we have a lot of fantastic board members that have really helped pave the way for the success of our organization. We got incredibly lucky. We got so many people with very specific expertise, all that were driven to do something about the lack of climate action and do something as a community for our island. So just like Bree said, over a series of potlucks, they identified the areas in which folks wanted to work and wanted to contribute some sort of whatever their personal gift was in terms of climate action. And yeah, through that, we've grown into an organization that was completely community member and volunteer based to an organization that now has a staff of 7, and and we are incredibly lucky to be in the position that we are. And we still are working every day with the community, with community members that are volunteering and giving up their time to help push and create these programs that bring a greater level of accessibility to climate action.
So, I mean, it's interesting that you have that many paid staff already. And obviously, back to the model idea for community action, not every other community needs to suddenly start with a staff of 7. You obviously didn't. Can you give me a general sense of where the funding comes from for 7 people? Beth, back to you.
Great question. Yeah, it's a combination of small donations from community members and grant funded work. And so, unfortunately, a significant amount of my time and other members of A Climate to Thrive's time is in grant writing. So since the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, there's been a lot more funding from the Department of Energy and other federal sources to fund a lot of this really local community-based work. There's also been an incredible amount of state funding that's come a lot through that federal funding that allows us to do this work with the municipalities and the community. So that is mainly where our funding comes from.
As somebody who's been on grants myself for many years, I can certainly appreciate that. Bree, go ahead.
Yeah, just one thing to add on that is that the other unique opportunity that exists there is we also do a lot of work that is linked to the state's Community Resilience Partnership Program, which offers grants to towns enrolled in the Community Resilience Partnership to pursue certain projects related to Manwant Wait, the state's climate goals. And many of our towns and municipalities here on the island are really driven to be leaders in the climate space and to take full advantage of that program, but may not have the dedicated staff capacity to carry out certain projects. And so we also, for example, the town of Tremont received a grant through the Community Resilience Partnership to fund the creation of a community resilience plan and contracted with A Climate to Thrive to carry out that work. So that is work that we've contracted with the towns, but comes at no expense to the taxpayer because it's funded through a state grant program. So there's a lot of those sort of nesting doll opportunities that help us operate.
And those are clearly climate related. I mean, not energy related.
Yes.
It could be culverts or raising roads or something like that.
Yes, exactly.
And given that the MDI by definition is coastal, there's lots of opportunities there. And I hadn't actually thought about that aspect of it. So that's really good. Have you guys engaged with Efficiency Maine at all? Probably individuals have, but do you guys as an organization have a relationship with Efficiency Maine?
We do. We, particularly when it comes to encouraging folks to weatherize and electrify their homes, we're it's really tremendous to be able to share the resources that Efficiency Maine has created and the incentives with our community. And so whenever we run programming or educational campaigns that are focused around, you know, heat pumps or electrification or weatherization, we always try to sort of partner with Efficiency Maine and bring their resources and insights to community members and make sure folks know that those are out there. And it's been really wonderful to see folks take advantage of that.
So Beth, do you have, obviously encouraging people to engage with Efficiency Maine is a no-brainer. Have there been other official, if you will, collaborations with Efficiency Maine, or really has it just been through their incentive programs?
I wonder what you mean by official. During a lot of our or all of our programs that we do, we roll out an intense community educational push alongside that program. And so when we do that, we invite members from Efficiency Maine to come into the community and talk about the efficiency programs that are available that will help support the program that we're doing. So for example, when we did a Weatherize MDI campaign, we had Efficiency Maine come and give a presentation about the rebates that they had surrounding insulation. The same thing when we did an Electrify MDI campaign or a Building Solutions campaign, they came in and spoke about the various rebates or loans that would be available to community members who are interested in getting those upgrades.
I guess what I was interested in relative to my question, and I wasn't very direct there, is Efficiency Maine has very prescriptive things on their website in terms of what they'll do. But they also have a program where if you come to them with a specific idea for energy reduction outside of their official table of incentives, they often will fund that. Has anything like that happened with you guys anywhere on the island?
Not to my knowledge. But that's great to know, and something that we can definitely explore.
And if you go back again a bunch of years on this program, I had the sustainability director for the University of New England on, who had done exactly what I just described and worked with Efficiency Maine. And I'm going to make these numbers up, but you know, they did something like a $500,000 project, and they got like maybe $300,000 from Efficiency Maine to support that project, and then wound up saving like $150,000 a year. You know, which is exactly what Efficiency Maine loves to hear. So just so you know, that is a possibility with them. And I will say that I remain disappointed in Efficiency Maine that they don't offer any solar rebates. I put solar on my lake camp in 2011, the last year they offered solar rebates. And I mean, it was a small rebate on top of the federal one. But as a result, I have not, pardon my phrase here, but I always use this phrase, I've not rented an electron in that building since 2011. I mean, we don't consume electrons, so I figure it's only renting, and I haven't rented one literally in 13 years. So I think there are opportunities there that I wish Maine would maybe take a little bit more advantage of, especially if you think back to the headlines I was just talking about in terms of the growth of solar and wind. But my question about, sorry, Beth, go ahead.
I was just going to say, thankfully, I totally agree. I wish there were rebates for solar available from Efficiency Maine. However, they are, I believe in the spring, the timeline's not super clear to me right now, but in the spring, they should be rolling out a green bank option or a green bank adjacent option to help finance solar for low and middle income individuals, which is great and something that we've been asking for a very long time.
Right. And I totally agree because solar is perceived by, shall we say, as something for wealthy people. And the incentive to my mind on the state level should in fact be income-based, however they turn out to do that. So I asked the question about Efficiency Maine, figuring that you would talk about, or it would lead into talking about weatherization and energy issues and heat pumps and things like that. Can you give me some either case examples of successes or any statistics on whether MDI has weatherized a greater percentage of homes than the state of Maine has, or installed more heat pumps, anything, any things along those lines that you can talk about that are literally saving people money? What do you think, Bree? She's looking at her computer.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that through past campaigns, right, we've had, I'm searching for the exact number here, but I know it's over 150 households enroll in a past weatherized program and really take advantage of those generous incentives that are out there, particularly for low and middle income Mainers. I think there's also evidence of win-wins on different scales as well. We're really happy to partner with and support the work of window dressers, which potentially is an avenue for, you know, even if the sort of 10% of the cost that's not covered by the efficiency main rebate is out of reach for you at the moment, you can still attend a window dressers community build and build an insulating storm insert for very low or no cost that is still going to save, each insert saves something like 10 gallons of fuel oil per year, which is not insignificant at all.
And they make you more comfortable, which is something that we don't always talk about.
Exactly. And comfort's a huge part of it. And I think the other thing that's become clear to us recently as a Climate to Thrive has also been engaged in providing some of the towns with greenhouse gas inventories at the community scale that help us get a better sense of where our emissions are coming from, is that this is true all across Maine, but particularly true here on the island. So many of us heat our homes and businesses with fuel oil, which after transportation is the single largest contributor to our greenhouse gas emissions on the island, is the way that we heat our homes. And so weatherizing and buttoning up our homes to decrease the amount of energy we need to heat them in the first place, and then electrifying that heat, can have an enormous impact on the greenhouse gas emissions that are coming from our communities' buildings, which is an increasingly key part of our work. Beth, I don't know if you have success stories from businesses. I know that businesses on the island have also pursued like REAP grants and funding and have seen a big difference in their fixed costs when they tackle those energy projects.
I'd be very interested in the business community response here.
Yeah, that's a great question. I can't put a number of kilowatts on it, but we've had an enormous success in terms of businesses wanting to participate in some form, whether it's heat pumps, weatherization, or putting solar on their roof. There, we've had an enormous amount of participation, and that's in no part from the REAP programs that have been rolled out. And so businesses now have more incentives than ever to participate in these types of programs. I believe 50% minimum kind of rebate for businesses if they install a solar array, which is 20% more than the average homeowner would see. And I'm sure you heard about this last week when you talked to Efficiency Maine, there's rebates that are getting better and better for businesses that are interested in putting in heat pumps or weatherization. There's just a huge amount of funding and incentives there. So we've seen a lot of participation from our businesses. I know of, I believe, a 100 kilowatt array that was just installed on a motel that had the year before just put in 32 heat pumps, and so they're able to heat and cool their place electrically. And now at this point, after the array is paid off, basically for free, so a lot of success.
So, a number of things came to my mind there as you guys were talking about these things, and let me see if I can drag some of them out of my brain here. So, how do you guys, and maybe you, Beth, how do you, shall we say, market solar power? And this is a bug that I have, and so I guess I will just say it rather than put you on the spot, and then you can reply to that if you want. This is something I've been saying. I was working with the town of Unity many years ago about actually using tax increment financing to make their downtown 100% solar. And so I gave some talks around in the area. And one of the things that I would always say is people hear, typically from the solar industry, which really bugs me, and I've had solar people on, and I get on my high horse on this one too for them, that say, I mean, today with the solar tax credit the way it is, maybe there's an 8-year payback on for solar panels. And so many people that I talk to say, 8-year payback, I'm not going to get anything back for 8 years. Why would I spend $20,000 and not get anything for 8 years? And my point to them is, if it's an 8-year payback, that take 100% divided by 8, you're earning 12% per year, risk-free. Where else can you do that? And they go, ooh, wow, and thought of it that way. And so, I mean, to me, the payback versus annual return is just a really key thing. So sorry, you don't have to reply to that if you don't want, but I just always make that point. It just makes so much sense to go in those, to think about it in that way. So one question for either one of you or both is the acceptance, if that's the right word, or participation perhaps in a Climate to Thrive from seasonal residents versus year-round residents. Can you compare that in any way?
Participation in a Climate to Thrive for year-round residents versus seasonal residents. First, I'm going to address the solar question that you had, and then I'll circle back to year-round versus seasonal. I like the way you put that. The way I typically communicate about solar with anyone who's interested in it, it's that if you end up financing your array, typically your payments are less than you're already paying for electricity. Mm-hmm. And so if you're 100% offsetting your electric bill with your solar array, why wouldn't you just want a smaller bill that eventually disappears versus one that you're just paying consistently and perpetually? I liken it very closely to renting your home versus owning your home. Except for it has a much shorter timeline to pay back. When you're paying your mortgage, you're working towards owning that house that you will eventually no longer need to make payments on. When you're renting, you're just paying your landlord, and you're not building that type of ownership or equity in your home. And so, it long term pays far more to be owning and investing in something that will eventually support you. That's typically how I like to talk about solar. And then I guess pivoting to your question about participation, we have an energy committee at a Climate to Thrive that meets monthly. And I would say probably 3/4 of it of participants are people that live on MDI year round. And then we also have a pretty passionate community of residents that have homes here, but live elsewhere during the cold season. And so, you know, we value both. And everyone that's at least participating in our energy committee that brings a lot of insight and a lot of support in their own unique way. So that's, I guess, what I'll say. In terms of participating in programs like our Electrify MDI program or our Solarize program, I don't have figures on that. And so I don't know that I could speak to that either way.
Okay. Bree, you want to add anything to that?
No, not much to add. I think that what Beth talked about in terms of building equity in your energy use. I also think of, I think you said renting an electron or something like that. What was your phrase, Steve, that you said earlier?
We don't consume electrons, so we all rent them.
Right, absolutely. I think that before I came to a Climate to Thrive was, I think, a new idea that an energy system could be something that was a force for building equity and prosperity in a community rather than just a bill that comes in on the kitchen table that you don't really think about or have any control over, which is, I think, most of our relationships to energy when just taken as is. But I think it's been a really powerful way to start conversations about how could we look at it differently. And then I think Beth is pretty right on the money in terms of the contributions that we really value both from year-round residents and our seasonal neighbors. Whenever we support the towns through planning processes, we always try to make sure that we're hearing from a wide array of voices, right? And that includes our seasonal neighbors. And we always do try to offer, right, like a Zoom version of programming that we do or other ways to participate for those that can't be there in person, whether because they're a seasonal resident or just because sometimes it's difficult to get out of the house in the winter in Maine. So we try to keep an eye on making sure that we're incorporating all of the voices that make up our community.
Right, right. And, I'm interested that you picked up on my renting an electron idea. It relates to sustainability and to something I talk about in my environmental classes. Does it make sense to take a resource provided by the planet and burn it up? And in terms of generating electricity, that's destructive, not sustainable. Whereas if we're not chewing up electrons, which we're not, and we're just generating them and generating them time and time again, it's the definition of sustainability. And so just, you know, another way to look at it. I'll just get back. And it doesn't sound like you really have information on whether MDI has a greater percentage of heat pumps or a greater percentage of homes have been weatherized or anything like that. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, that data is really hard to actually quantify. Okay. It's really easy for me to tell you exactly how much solar we have, but when it comes down to who has installed a heat pump or who has insulated their homes, we only have the data on who's participated in our program, like from the beginning to the end. There are plenty of community members that have gone on to insulate their home or install a heat pump that have been to our educational programs, but may not have necessarily done their weatherization or heat pump installation with the contractor that we were partnered with at the time. It's really hard to put a number on those installations. Yeah.
So a related question, and this is something that we talk about from time to time on this program, is to what extent have you gotten acceptance, buy-in, or membership by either contractors or architects? Because those guys are kind of the key to a lot of this stuff.
They really are. We've had fantastic relationships with contractors, the boots on the ground that are doing this work. It's been, these relationships take time to cultivate, but once they're there, are enormously beneficial. I now know who to call when I have a question about specific electrical system design. And I can call multiple different contractors all working on the same type of thing and get a level of clarity that would be really difficult to get if we didn't have the relationships that we do. On top of that, they're fantastic allies to have in terms of looking at the type of policies that we need in Maine to support our workforce and to support this clean energy transition. They're the people that are actually doing this work and getting these things installed, and so they know where the gaps are. And it's through that relationship and the work that we've been doing in our own community that we've been able to see where those equity gaps are, and be able to push for things, that benefit all community members, not just the wealthy. Yeah.
We've had a couple of contractors on this program over the last 6 years, I guess, that it's been on the air, and a couple of architects as well. But the frustration to me, if I may just editorialize again, is that too many contractors want to get in and get out, and so they're throwing bat insulation into the wall. That's spelled BAD, by the way, but not sealing it up. So you know there's air leaks everywhere. And the state of Maine, I believe, the legislature is still talking about the possibility of contractor licensing, which other states do have. And frankly, I mean, it's regulation and it's paperwork, but I just really think if we're going to be serious about energy and climate change, we need to go there. And, you know, ditto for architects. There's very few architects out there who talk about passive house standards and things like that. And I mean, in chatting with Opal out of Belfast, I mean, their numbers are that it costs 6 or 7% more to build a passive house, and you save that back in the first year or two in your energy costs. So it just makes tons of sense.
Yeah. Oh, I would just add on to what you're saying. You're right that there needs to be accountability within the contracting world. And I think that's one of the benefits of the programs that we run at A Climate to Thrive, like our Solarize and our Weatherize and our Electrify MDI campaigns. We do the work of vetting the contractors long before we bring them to the community. It's really hard for an individual to go out and get quotes from three different contractors and wondering, well, this one's more expensive, but they say that their quality of work is better, and really knowing which direction to go, which path to go down. And so we do that pre-vetting, and then we have those long-term relationships that help build in accountability within those contractors. So we know that when they show up to do the work, they're not going to be doing a terrible job. That's all I'd add to that.
That's a super good thing to hear. And really essential relative to, you know, the goals that you guys and we all should be going with. And that matters. I mean, there's an example of why it would matter for another community to adopt this this model. Bree, do you want to, are you in the person who perhaps can make the pivot to electric vehicles and electric charging on MDI?
I can certainly do my best. I think that another way in which A Climate to Thrive has sought to cultivate a transition that really benefits communities is making it more feasible for folks to start driving an EV. And I think when I talk about this work with folks who are a little bit less familiar with the area, there's a sort of hope that's inherent in the, you know, if you can make it work in rural Maine, you can make it work in a lot of different places as well. And so one of the early projects that A Climate to Thrive was involved in was establishing a charging corridor of EV chargers sort of up and down East Maine. So if you stop at a charger in Belfast or heading up towards Cutler, you might see the old A Climate to Thrive logo on some of these chargers. And that was a real collaborative effort with different businesses and towns along that route. We've also worked with the island towns to site EV chargers with attentiveness to placing them in locations where they would be accessible to renters who drive EVs but who can't install a charger in their home. I think that there was a real emphasis in being thoughtful about siting these EV chargers so that they can benefit those for whom an electric vehicle might not otherwise be possible or feasible. And so recognizing, right, that we want folks to potentially consider driving an EV if it works for them, but we also have to do as much legwork as we possibly can to make that doable for folks. And I think that that has been a really important part of our work. We've also hosted EV ride and drives so that folks can talk to other members of their communities who drive their EVs and love their EVs, right, from a sort of goofy looking 2012 old Nissan Leaf to the brand new Ford Lightning, right? Trying to help folks see the range of options that are out there to them and meet other community members who, you know, they're not trying to sell them anything. They're just having an honest conversation about their experience driving an EV. And that's been a really fruitful set of conversations too.
And let me just add that one message that I talk about here on this program is any family that has two cars, almost universally, a family should have one EV in if they've got two cars, because one car is commuting to work rather than driving to Denver. And, you know, maybe it's a little early to try to drive an EV to Denver, but you can certainly do your commuting, no problem. And even a plug-in, depending on the length of your commute, can be really important. I bought the first ever Prius plug-in, which only had like 15 miles of range, but if we were driving it around town or most of a tank, sometimes you would get 60 or 70 miles per gallon in a tank. And that's, you know, that's offsetting CO2 and reducing our costs big way. in a big way. You mentioned charters on in island communities. I presume you mean on MDI, not literally offshore islands. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know of any EV chargers that exist on offshore islands, though. That's such an interesting combination of challenges. Something interesting that has been emerging lately, and the Island Institute has been following this and doing some work on this, is electric ferries and sort of the question of marine electrification, which is, I mean, that's certainly not a Climate to Thrive's wheelhouse, but it's something that I have been following with a lot of interest into seeing what, yeah, what that future of transit infrastructure looks like and the potential opportunities there.
And there are some people out there using electric lobster boats, you know, so,
yeah.
You know, boats are something we haven't thought a lot about, but it certainly makes an awful lot of sense. Relative to electrification, do you have any electrification case studies on the island where people have gone fully electric in their homes? It looks like they're not sure. I'll give you my own story while you think for a minute longer. I went 100% electric in my home here in Waterville in 2016. Took the old boiler out. It was noisy, and I only used it for a short time after I bought the house. I've got two heat pumps. I've got a hybrid water heater, and it's a 1948 house, so it's not that well insulated. But I'll mention that in a second here. But my total electric bill last year, my total energy bill for cooking, lights, and heating and cooling was $1,200. And frankly, I don't think there's very many people around that can say that. And I will mention relative to, we talked about insulating, resulting in more comfort as well as energy savings. The other thing, my North Slope roof had wicked ice dams before I put in blown-in insulation up there. I've not scraped that roof in 7 years. So little ways like that can save damage to your home, save energy, keep an elderly person from getting injured on a ladder. All this stuff makes sense. So sorry, I went off on a tangent there, but come back. Any electrification stories that you can think of?
Yeah, there are several families across the island that have gone all electric, and a lot that have done so through our programs. I can think of a family in Bar Harbor that insulated their home with our weatherized program, installed heat pumps with our Electrify MDI program, and finally put solar on their roof through our solarized MDI program. And now they have virtually no electricity bills because they sized their solar panels to match what their electrical load would be after installing those heat pumps. They also bought an EV because of how efficient their home had become. And so that's one example I can think of. I don't have the numbers in front of me in terms of the size of each of those projects that combined to make that household so efficient. That's anecdotally the experience of many people across the island. Yeah.
And Bree, I just want to come back to something that I jotted down here, but didn't pursue. You mentioned that there are Climate to Thrive labeled chargers out there. Tell me a little bit more about how that came about.
Yes. So this was a project that was led by Gordon Beck, who was an amazing member of the Climate to Thrive team. So I certainly don't have all the details on this, but that was what I was speaking about with the charging corridor throughout down East Maine that we helped to sort of design and establish. And that was a program where, you know, we received a large grant that could pay for the chargers themselves. And so all we had to do was work with towns and other partners along the route to install those chargers. And the idea was, right, like making sure that it was deeply doable to drive up and down East Maine in an EV, stopping for, you know, a certain unit of time at these given chargers. So yeah, if there might be, if there's a sort of public level 2 charger out there, there may or may not be an Climate to Thrive sign next to it. But I mean, it's wonderful news that chargers have proliferated so rapidly that they're by no means the only game in town these days. And that's really fantastic news for EV drivers and everyone who hopes to one day possibly drive an EV.
Are these at rest stops or at restaurants or where are they?
It varies. So there's one right off of sort of, I'm thinking of one in Belfast, which is sort of in a public parking lot. There's some that are I think there's a few at rest stops. There's some in libraries, there's some in municipal buildings, there's some in sort of typical lots as well. I think it's intentionally a mixture of places.
Libraries makes a lot of sense. I hadn't thought of that one. It's always bugged me that there's not more at restaurants where you, by definition, spend long enough to actually charge your car a fair bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's been really interesting looks into this in places like Millinocket and other more rural places too. There's also an argument for EV charging infrastructure as an incentive for economic development, right? Mm-hmm. If someone's passing through your town and they can stop and plug in for half an hour at an EV charger, they'll go have lunch in a local business, right? And that could be a huge, huge asset there as well. So when we are able to thoughtfully site these chargers in these places where you can walk to access services, there's a real potential for a win-win there too.
Right. We did an electric vehicle drive-in, I guess it was in 2019 because it was before COVID, at Thomas College, and had, like 8 or 10 people show up, wanting to show off their cars. And I did a little research on it at that time. And in 2019, there were 350 electric vehicle chargers in the state of Maine. And I haven't seen a recent number, but it might be double that, I suppose. So it's imminently doable. So we're down to about 5 minutes here. And so I guess the one question that I would have for you guys is, what are your goals for the future for our climate to thrive? What are your hopes? Or do you literally have goals to say we're going to be X percent renewable energy by 2030 or something like that? And you can contrast that, if you want to, with the Maine Won't Wait climate plan.
That's a great question, Steve. It actually relates really closely to a project that I'm working on over the next 12 months or so. Where I'm going to be mapping the island and the possible pathways to energy independence. And I'm doing that with a lot of community input, right? We were formed by the community. And so the community should have a lot of input into this plan. But essentially, I'll be looking at the amount of weatherization, electrification, and generation that we'll need in order to achieve our goal of energy independence. And so, there's not just one pathway to do that. There are multiple. And so what we'll be doing over the next 12 months is getting pulling on a lot of our community members for their input into this plan and to what important aspects, what's important to them in terms of land use, in terms of economic investment. And so I think that's really going to help shape our final goal. Yeah.
What's the current mix on the island now relative to, at least generalize? So you've got there's solar, obviously. Is there any wind power? There's not. Okay. How about biomass?
No, we don't have biomass. We do actually, I know that we do have a couple very small wind generators on the island, one at Beach Hill Farm, and there was one at the Southwest Harbor Elementary School, but I believe it's broken right now.
COA used to have at least one. I don't know if they still do.
Yeah, but we have a lot of solar on the island. We have over 4 megawatts now, and that's all of distributed, locally owned and sited clean energy generation. We do not have a subscription array up yet, or a community solar array that's owned by an outside developer interconnected yet. There is one being built, but that's not part of that 4 megawatt statistic yet, and that's 10 times more than we had when A Climate to Thrive first started, which we're quite proud of. Yeah,
that sounds great. The solar array on the high school, is that a power purchase agreement, or is that owned by the town?
So that will be owned by the school when the buyout occurs. So that's going to be happening within the next 18 months to 2 years. That's when that flip will occur.
Typically, yeah. The buyout happens for that at 6 years when when the tax credit decreases. So you don't have any solar farms, though. So anybody
We do have solar farms, but they're owned by the community. So we have the Tremont array that's built on a landfill. We have the Revision array that is built on another landfill in Southwest Harbor. And those have shares that are owned by different community members within on the, mostly on the island, but a few just in Burson territory. Yeah.
I'm so glad to hear that they are on landfills. And maybe my final question here, and again, maybe it's a very simple answer, but it's as part of the things that I talk about that I don't think people are talking about relative to getting Maine to 100% renewable grid is tidal power. You know, what an opportunity to have tidal power, you know, on all the islands, islands you can drive to and peninsulas. Relative to having decentralized renewable energy. Have you heard of any conversation about anything like that?
There are murmurings of it. We haven't, at least to my knowledge, no one on the island has really looked into it very deeply. But that may change in the next year or two.
We'll take looked into it deeply as a pun, in terms of tidal power. Well, so thank you very much for being on the program and giving us the 2 cents worth and the 3 cents worth on a climate to thrive. You've been listening to Power for the People here on WERU FM 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor, with guests from A Climate to Thrive on MDI, Brianna Cunliffe, the Community Engagement and Resilience Coordinator. Funded through the Island Institute. Thank you very much to them. And Beth Woolfolk, the Manager of Renewable Energy and Planning and Policy. Power for the People airs the fourth Wednesday in the Public Affairs time slot at 4 p.m. Join us next time to learn more about energy topics, policies, technology, and solutions for your life. Thank you so much.